Greetings, amigos. This episode brings you lawyer, venture capitalist, and founder Peter Crane. As you'll quickly realize as you listen, Peter is not your average. Though starting out as a trial lawyer, Peter made a brilliant string of unconventional investments that eventually springboarded him into a life of venture capital. And as far as Peter Crane, the human, goes, well, he's a rare breed and I love it. On this episode, you'll hear the story of how Peter and I met, why Adapt Capital is using technology to improve the environment and the developing world, as well as how the man came to be a venture capitalist and enthusiast of decentralization. Welcome Through the Wire with Peter Crane.
Jarvis, drop my needle.
Peter Crane, welcome Through the Wire.
Hello, Jeremy. How are you?
Good, good. Really glad to have you on today.
It's a pleasure to be on with you. Thank you for having me.
Our pleasure is mine. So I want to start this one out kind of with the story of how we met. And, you know, for everyone listening, you know, Peter is he's a venture partner at Adapt Capital. He's been in film. He's a lawyer. And we're at this, we're at a business conference, you know, people coming from all over the world. It's like a really gorgeous event, the Summit Series. And Peter catches my eye because he's wearing this fierce lion t-shirt and a baseball cap. And I just thought that was the coolest thing in the room. And we started talking and here we are.
Yeah, it was great running into you at Summit. That was a wonderful conference and lots of great people, as you mentioned, from all over the world. Really a pleasure meeting you and everyone there. And yeah. Grateful to the organizers for throwing a good conference.
Mm-hmm, couldn't agree more. Shout out to Eric and Max. And we'll see that thing continue to grow. But yeah, and for what I understand, there's a whole backstory behind that shirt as well, but we'll save that for a round two.
Okay, that sounds good.
So Peter, you've been in startups, you know, around technology for a long time now. But I want to, before we get there, I want to talk about you, you know, where you came from, you know, your story and just kind of paint a picture of how Peter became Peter Crane.
Sure. In a nutshell, I was born and raised in California, but I was a hybrid between Southern and Northern California. I was born in Los Angeles, and my parents moved to the Bay Area when I was in grammar school. So I switched schools and went to high school in Marin County at Redwood High School. And after that, I went to UCLA and got a degree in political science and psychology. Dual major, and randomly took a class in college called legal writing. I don't even know why I signed up for it. And the teacher pulled me aside, and she said, "You know, I was listening to you because we had to write a position paper and argue it with a classmate." And she said, "I was listening to you, and you have the talent it takes to be a trial lawyer, and it's a very rare talent." And she really encouraged me to consider law school. And that planted the seed, so I ended up going to law school after UCLA and graduated and went to work for a big firm and represented Fortune 500 companies for a while.
Wow. And so tell us about that. Like, why are you not representing Fortune 500 companies anymore?
Yeah, that's a great question. I was enjoying the work for a while, and at some point, though, I became very clear that I wanted to be engaged in day-to-day life rather than sort of picking up the pieces when things went wrong or helping people maneuver. I wanted to actually be engaged in transacting with other human beings and not, giving advice. I wanted to be active and out there and looking at new things. And, I just felt like I was assisting people live their lives rather than living my own. So I became super motivated to go into the business world. And a great opportunity came along. Well, a high school friend of mine decided to compete with Red Bull. And he, the first competitor to Red Bull was Rockstar Energy Drink.
Right.
I think you might have heard of it.
Yeah.
And so he pulled me into the fold very early. I was on the founding team in 1999. And, you know, that took off and that whet my appetite for consumer products. And I helped other people launch other brands and I started investing in consumer products. And I was an early investor in GoPro, for example. And then once I got out into the business world, I became further clear that I wanted to do something to help people. And then that was my calling in life. And I felt it should be everyone's calling, ideally. So I launched two supplement brands. And you know, I felt really good about that. But in the process of doing business, I realized that the bigger issue wasn't access to products that can make you healthier, but on a global scale, access to capital to lead a healthy life. And really that financial issues were afflicting the majority of humans on the planet. And that became clear to me. And I was waiting for an opportunity that I could jump on to financially empower people. Rather than offer another product. But nothing really materialized until I started hearing a lot of my friends start talking about Bitcoin. And at first I sort of blew it off and I thought to myself, hey, it sounds kind of scammy or it didn't really make sense. You know, a store of digital value, it didn't really register initially. But I finally took a deep dive on it and it became clear to me through my research that it was really a true way to provide economic opportunity for people. And so access, like I said, it wasn't about access to products. It was more about providing economic opportunities and enfranchising those who don't have, you know, access to regular banking, and 90% of the people on the planet don't have access to last mile fiber. So they're disenfranchised from the internet. And it really just comes down to financial empowerment. It did in my mind's eye. So when I realized that the cryptocurrencies and the blockchain technology that powers them was the first vehicle that I was aware of that could meaningfully address the issue of economic opportunity, I jumped in head first, and through an introduction from a friend, I got involved in a project called Freight Network. And the focus of that blockchain project was to create a platform that would transparently align truckers with shippers. And, you know, in the US market, it's a $200 billion a year sector. And the issue was that the intermediaries, the brokers, weren't really concerned so much about filling trucks as they were about their commissions. And by creating a transparent layer using blockchain technology to connect shippers and truckers with each other directly, and also permit the brokers to engage the platform as well, we found that we could save the shippers 20 to 30% on their shipping costs and get those trucks filled. So the truckers could make a full salary, so to speak, for the loads they drive around. And the amazing you know, extra benefit of creating that platform was that in filling the trucks, we're making a meaningful impact on reducing the carbon footprint that truckers make. And you know, climate change is a very significant issue for me, and I believe for the planet and everyone on it, everything on it. So that felt really good as well to be able to address that issue with this platform. So right. That was my first foray into the blockchain world, was helping the team at Freight Network get launched.
That's very cool. Yeah, and it's, you know, just from, you know, looking at your track record, it's very clear that you have this concern for you know, the planet and everything on it. I love the way you say that. And, you know, I tend to agree with that. You know, it's, we're all part of this just one ecosystem. And, you know, it's not that the tools aren't available. You know, they don't exist to make yourself healthier, to improve lives, to fix, you know, the climate. It's just that the, like you said, the capital is just distributed in a backwards kind of way, you know, and yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. If, who knows? I mean, if blockchain is the stylus to help us point in the right direction, then that's perfect. But, you know,
it is, and to speak to that point briefly, it's the first time in human history where we've had a digital system to transparently and immutably transact with other human beings, free from censorship or inefficiencies or agendas that have been imposed upon us throughout history from medieval times by intermediaries such as governments and central banks. Mm-hmm. So it's really exciting time to be in technology right now. It's absolutely mind-blowing. And when you combine it with other fourth generation technologies, the advancement of AI, the connection of all information and transactions via the Internet of Things, and big data and analytics, it really creates a perfect soup, so to speak, for humans to advance themselves economically and also, I believe, spiritually, because if you create a trust layer for humans to transact from, you know, there's no getting away with any of this monkey business anymore, and you can really see how trust is essential to maximizing both the financial and the experience of living, because it's so much better when you can come from a place of feeling that you can trust who you're dealing with, and there's a record, and you can look at their history, and you know that they weren't able to, you know, fudge anything they're saying or anything they said they did in the past, because the blockchain creates this permanent, transparent record of all transactions.
Mm-hmm, right. It almost incentivizes morality.
It does. I feel that technology is actually incentivizing the spiritual revolution that will come into play at the same time as a financial revolution, as people become more financially empowered by removing the inefficiencies that intermediaries have created in the current economic system.
That's awesome. So one thing that really interests me about you, Peter, is this, like, you know, the interest in all of these things, right? And I'm wondering, you know, where did this stem, this altruism? You know, when you were in elementary school, were you the, you know, the kid who was always giving away his lunch, parts of his lunch to, you know, because you didn't eat anymore? Or, you know, where did this come from? Is your family very selfless and volunteering? And, you know, how is it engendered itself in your life?
Well, ironically, I was giving my lunch away to animals because my mom was a health nut, and she made these crazy vegetarian sandwiches that I was literally embarrassed to eat in front of my friends who had their white bread and bologna. And I'd throw them in the bushes on the way to school and buy like the deli sandwich when I got there.
That's funny.
So it's funny you brought the giving the food up issue, but in reality, the altruism was instilled upon me after law school. I took a little bit of time off and traveled to India. I'd gone through a breakup that was really hard for me with the woman I thought I was going to marry at the time. And I was very sad about the breakup, and I started reading a lot of books on happiness, and that led me to find Buddhism, and I wanted to go straight to the source, and I went and lived in India and Nepal for a year. And I studied under the lamas that the Dalai Lama trained, and learned a ton about Tibetan Buddhism.
Wow, that's fascinating. So did you how long did you spend there?
You know, I just spent about a year in India and Nepal studying Buddhism.
That's amazing. And people say too that, so I'm very interested in that, you know, that part of the world. And they say that even if you're not doing, you know, sort of a spiritual journey, it becomes spiritual just because the Indian community and just, you know, the East Asian is very, they're very communal and connected. Yeah. And they have that sense of family. And that's something that is lost in Western culture a lot of time.
Yeah. Two highlights from the studying Buddhism aspect of being in that part of the world for a decent amount of time. One thing that was really striking to me immediately was that the people there, you know, literally had nothing in terms of financial resources, and they seemed happier than most of the people I met in California that had tons of resources. Mm-hmm. So that was very eye-opening. And then the whole concept of arranged marriage, which is common in India, was very foreign to me. And I finally had the courage to ask someone, you know, how does this work? You know, how do you marry someone that you're not in love with, you don't really know yet? And this Indian man looked at me and he said, in America, you fall in love and get married. And in India, you get married and fall in love.
That's awesome.
That was kind of mind blowing to me, but it made sense, I guess, in retrospect.
Maybe I should move to India.
Maybe. going back to the crypto, do you want to go back to the crypto stuff?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it all plays together too. You know, this, the values that you learn from, you know, this very mindful experience and your learning under the lamas have now spiraled into, you know, your actions and, you know, you're trying to contribute to this redistribution of wealth, because that's essentially what the blockchain can do. And if they succeed, you know, if we take this technology and actually put it on the coattails of something great, then, you know, that's the ultimate goal, right?
Yeah. And what makes me so inspired and passionate about the space, truly, is that it's the first time in human history that we actually have a meaningful tool to put the brakes on, you know, an escalating, unsustainable and cruel level of wealth inequality. Is really what it comes down to. And I got involved right at the perfect time, it seems, because I got to watch, as I was working in the space, I got to watch the space grow from almost nothing to a combined market cap of over $750 billion. Mm-hmm. And that was really validating to my efforts, because I've seen that there was mass adoption occurring and that this was a global phenomena. And I was meeting people from all over the world that were equally excited and passionate about the space. So it's all very reinforcing. Even though we were all pioneers, and to some extent we still are, the technology is still very young, and we're still working very hard to validate the use cases for it. The signs are all positive and clear, you know, that with current projections, within 3 years, half of all the companies that come to the planet will adopt blockchain to conduct business.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it almost just happened like too quickly. You know, where everyone was really crazy about it, you know, so now people, the ones that are like, oh, it's dead. It's just like, no, it's just that it can't, like, it doesn't work that way. You know, the world doesn't change on a dime.
No, everything's a process. But when anyone expresses skepticism, one thing that I fall back on very comfortably is the notion that literally since medieval times, we've had the last advancement in accounting was a double entry ledger, where transactions were verified by two data points. And now, for the first time in hundreds of years, we have a major shift in how we can validate transactions. And with the blockchain, you have a triple entry ledger. It's a digital ledger, and it's secured by cryptography. And what that does, if you put everything else aside, that creates a new standard of care. So if you're in fintech and you're handling money or anything of value, you would be risking liability by not using blockchain technology. Does that make sense?
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's like really not locking your house up, but living in a nice home.
Well, yeah, it'd be like you're an accountant and you're not eventually adopting, blockchain technology to, secure, make a transparent, immutable record of your client's financial transactions. You're not living up to the standard of care anymore. Mm. So you're going to go the way of the dinosaur at some point or get sued or both,
Right. Yeah. Especially when you're handling other people's money. So
exactly.
So just to,
and that's where it gets really interesting, because what governments do, all they do is handle their taxpayers' money. Mm. And if we can implement blockchain technology in governance,
yes,
then things get really interesting. When we get to see where every penny goes, I think you're going to see a major shift in how taxpayer money is spent, and it's going to be a shift for the better.
Peter, I've been saying the same thing. The moment I got interested in this space was maybe like 3 years ago. I said, this is a government. The government needs to introduce this. That's when it'll all leak down and it would change everything. I think you're 100% right.
Yeah. And it has other implications. So for example, I'm an advisor to a project called Buildcoin, and they are encouraging adoption in the space of governance by putting public infrastructure, major public infrastructure projects onto the blockchain. And, unfortunately, what you find when taxpayer money is being doled out in massive amounts for public projects, there's an incredible inefficiency and corruption and overbilling and so forth. And if you have a transparent digital ledger, if it's blockchain enabled, so to speak, then you save so much money that it really propels everyone involved in government to look at it seriously and consider adopting in other areas besides public infrastructure projects. So that's one way for getting the blockchain out into the world of governance, is by showing how it can save money when it comes to massive, multi-billion dollar projects and their securing deal, major deals for, multi-billion dollar projects in countries like Brazil and Mexico and so forth. So that's a very exciting project. And then also when it comes to something very important now, you see in the headlines all the time, this data privacy issue that Facebook has really brought to the forefront of people's minds. Who owns your data? Why don't you own it? Why don't you get to share in the revenue your data creates? And now there are blockchain projects, one of which I advise, MBYS, which is a LinkedIn of sorts, but you always own your data. And should you choose to share it with people that mine employment data, then you share in the revenue from selling that data. But you get to choose whether or not that data gets released and sold. Right. And that's what's so critical with respect to data privacy. And my good friend, Brittany Kaiser, who was the whistleblower in the whole, data analytical scandal, you know, that one?
Mm-hmm.
She's been, spearheading the efforts around, awareness for data privacy and ownership and speaking around the world about that. And she's an amazing person and inspired me to consider that aspect and how blockchain could assist with helping people reclaim the ownership and rights to their own data.
Right. Oh, that's awesome. Yeah. And those are two, sometimes when, and for people listening, I'm sure you're thinking, ledgers and all these highfalutin terms, and they don't actually really know what it is unless they've really done a deep dive. And I mean, so bring it down to earth a little bit, Peter. You mentioned Bill and Mexico, and we won't ask you to like describe the technology, but for just the average person, maybe a migrant coming to America from South America, how would it affect their lives, and how could something like a cryptocurrency or even Bitcoin?
There's two. I think I can give two quick examples. So I advise a company called Hip Property, based in London. they are digitizing real estate assets and making those investments that were typically reserved for very wealthy individuals available to anyone. They can get in it, they can participate at any level of investment. They can own a fraction of a piece of property by buying into a digital property-backed currency. But that holds true for every single asset class in the world. So what you're going to see is trillions of dollars of assets that have been traditionally traded from, you know, property to stocks to gold and other precious metals. They are all going to be digitized, and that'll create access to every person on the planet. If they want to invest, they don't have to buy any, you know, there's no set minimum. You can buy any amount you want. So that's going to provide financial empowerment for people in investing. But in terms of transacting, you've seen banks take large fees. They take monthly fees. They take $3 when you want your own money out of the ATM. They take, you know, a lot of money out of the ecosystem. Now with Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies, we can transact with each other directly. There's no bank. There's no intermediary. There's a fee that's so small it's irrelevant that the miners take by validating the transactions on the triple entry digital ledger. We're bringing a lot of money back to the ecosystem that everyone gets to enjoy a more direct experience of the value of the goods and services they're providing to other people in the world.
Right. It's almost like a stock market for everything. You can almost think of it like you can buy one share in a company that's absolutely massive. You know, you can buy one little piece of an apartment building, you know, it's all, exactly. All a certain small amount of money. That's very
exactly. Yeah. So I'm definitely on two projects I can't mention because they're still stealth, but working as well to enable everyone on the planet to have access to data so that they can participate in the system. And then also enable cross-border payments so that, you know, people around the world can transact with each other directly, whereas before they always needed to rely on a bank, you know, to wire money at a very significant cost. You know, $45 is a typical, $45-$50 is a typical wire, international wire fee. And that, you know, if you just want to, like, you know, sell a little bit of your time or sell some item that you have that's not worth that, it comes almost invalidates the transaction. Now we have a cheap way to send money to each other globally. It's so financially empowering.
Our mutual friend has a strong dislike, we'll say, for Western Union, if you remember.
For good reason.
Yeah. So I won't eat up too much more of your time, Peter, but...
But I did want to say that what I did realize, though, ultimately, after working with several projects, which was extremely rewarding, and I love all these founders, and they're all passionate, but then finding a group of people that I could work with now, I was so blessed to have this opportunity with Adapt Capital because it's an impact fund. And so we are going to financially empower those that are seeking to financially empower all the people in the world.
That's amazing. Yeah. And you know, you said something before that really resonated. You said you found that you were assisting people live their lives rather than living your own. And, you know, now it seems like you've found the balance between the two, and that's a perfect place to be. But, so let's, you know, I'm going to ask a few more questions before we wrap up, that I, you know, just posed to everyone. So any, you know, books, they could be books you picked up in India or, you know, a TED talk, or you mentioned Brittany Kaiser before. So any people that, you know, you'd say look up for a podcast or maybe someone I should talk to, you know, just things that you've, or humans or books that you find compelling, interesting, inspiring.
Yeah. I mean, there's such a wealth of information available, and you could, you know, Google a TED talk on any topic and it would give you the most relevant results. So, what I would suggest, and something that I found to be the most helpful in the past year of my life, I read a book called Power Versus Force. Have you heard of that book?
No. Who's it by?
So, you know, I don't remember the author's name. But, I'm sure we can look that up.
Yeah, oh, it'll be.
But Power Versus Force is a book that scientifically proves beyond a shadow of a doubt that not only can we trust our gut, but we must trust our gut to be healthy and productive in life. Hmm. And it scientifically proves that proposition. So I found that to be an amazing source of inspiration for my personal life. Because I always, you know, was curious, can I trust my gut? Is my gut going to lead me the wrong way? But that book makes clear that we can and must trust our gut. So that was a beautiful book to read.
That's awesome.
I recommend it.
Yeah, I wonder, I'll definitely check that out. I wonder what someone like Daniel Kahneman, who kind of goes the opposite direction, would think. Yeah, and I think the real answer, as is everything in life, is it's the middle ground. You know, sometimes you don't want to trust your gut because it's telling you, oh, you don't want to go for a run today. You know, I'm tired. But sometimes the gut knows a lot more intuitively than what your head's thinking.
No, the gut sends messages to your body, and it's just a matter of whether your mind is picking up on them. So one of the major studies the book employed was they would get a room full of people and hand out what appeared to be empty envelopes, but some of the envelopes contain traces of artificial sweetener, which has been proven to be very bad for you recently. Aspartame, for example, which was found in most diet sodas, it turns out, you know, it causes all sorts of illnesses. So without fail, without exception, every single person that got the envelope with trace amounts of artificial sweetener in it had a weaker muscle test result than the people that had the completely empty envelopes.
That
was really interesting. Yeah.
Huh. Okay. So you literally meant the gut, like what you're ingesting through your mouth. I thought you meant like...
No, these people wouldn't... They would just be handed an envelope, and all the envelopes felt the same. Some had traces of artificial sweetener in them, and then their arm muscle would be weaker if they had the envelope with the artificial sweetener in it than if they had the envelope without it.
I got to check it out. That sounds awesome. Cool.
So the author of Power Versus Force is David Hawkins.
Oh, David Hawkins. Okay. Appreciate that. All right. So the last question is one that I pose to all my guests. So I'll just ask you, if you could reach 1 million people tomorrow on a text message, you know, they wake up in the morning, it's the first thing they read, and it informs their day, what would it say? And, you know, this could be something as long as, you know, a paragraph. It could be 5 words. It could even just be, you know,
mantra. That's a simple one. It's an Albert Einstein quote, and I'm going to paraphrase it because I don't know how to feel
the
word. But in essence, that the purpose of life is to find your gift. Mm-hmm. And then to give it away.
Huh. Find your gift.
So you find what your gift is, and then you give that away, and you help others, basically, is what Albert Einstein was saying, is that the purpose of life is to help others. And I think that's what he's saying.
Build the human community. And the
global whatever community, that looks not like even for you. Whatever, everyone has a gift, and whatever that gift is, they can use it to help others, and that's the bottom line.
That's amazing. Peter, this is great. Thanks for your time.
Yeah, my pleasure.